Rav Cohen. He's here tonight to talk about Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, who is a very controversial, clean-shaven Kabbalist. So I'd like to turn the floor over to Rav Cohen.
I thank Rabbi Kungir for those very generous exaggerations. I want to thank Rabbi Klinger and Rabbi Morgenstern for making this happen. I want to thank Harriet Levitt, or as I referred her in the precincts of MTA, Rebitson Levitt, for really being the initiator of this idea. I'm very excited to spend some time with you. Oh,
thank you.
Perfect. I'm very excited to get together with you tonight and spend some time talking about a really remarkable person. I understand that some of you will be heading on a mission to Central and Eastern Europe in the next couple of weeks. So hopefully between tonight and next week, we'll have a chance to contextualize that mission. Whether or not you're going on the mission, I want to introduce you tonight to a fascinating man. Now, when we think of the funny thing about associations, when I say Musar Sefer, right, a work of Jewish ethics, Jewish self-improvement. So I imagine the sort of the visual that comes to mind for many of us would probably be, if I can guess correctly, old man, long white beard, maybe a dusty book, someone who's very otherworldly. Maybe we conjure up a medieval picture in our mind. And one of the remarkable things about the author, what's probably the most popular Musar Sefer ever published, it's gone through 150 printings over the last less than 300 years, he was none of those things. He never had a long white beard because he never had a beard and never made it long enough for his beard, hypothetical beard, to have turned white. He's a remarkable Moshe Chaim Lutzato, author of Mesil Sashar, The Path of the Just, was a remarkable man who was a poet and a playwright, an optician, and a man who, within several decades of his passing in the mid-1700s, was widely accepted across every stream of Judaism imaginable. We'll speak next week about the late 1700s, the fierce fight over the rise of Hasidus, between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, the anti-Hasidim. And in the midst of that all, both sides claim Ramchal as their own. Mordechai Kaplan wrote an important work on Mesilas Yesharim. He's remarkably accepted across the board. In his lifetime, he was, as we'll discover tonight, he was literally kicked across Europe. And his books were banned and buried and perhaps even burned. And he was a subject of incredible controversy. I want to share with you the story of Ramchal, and then we'll perhaps begin to appreciate the man behind the work. But although, I could trouble you, if you care for, some people enjoy text, some people do not. So if that's something that you appreciate, feel free to take and pass. As you see on the timeline, the first side of the page, he lived a short life. His historians are not sure exactly when he died, but he lived around 40 years, the early 1700s. But to begin to appreciate the strangeness of his life, we need to step back. We need to step back to the mid-1600s, and let's even step back a moment to the 1500s. Or the 30 to 90 second thumbnail portrait, the last 2,000 years of Jewish history. If we could summarize, you know, the view from 30,000 feet breaks down, loosely speaking, I apologize for approximating, but loosely speaking, the last 2,000 years since the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, break down into roughly four sets of 500 years each. From, again, approximately the year 1 to the year 500, give or take, is the Tanam Namaram, the writing of Mishnah and Talmud. The next 500 years, approximately, from 500 to 1,000, is the period of the Gaonim, post-Talmudic, but the center of Jewish gravity, certainly the center of Jewish intellectual gravity, still very much in Babylonia and Iraq in the Middle Ages. Around the year 1,000 marks the transition from the period of the Gaonim to the period of the Rishonim, late Middle Ages. And what's really unique about it is that's when you see the sort of the shift of intellectual Jewish focus from the Middle East westward to the Mediterranean. At that point, you already have Rishonim, Ashkenazim, and Sephardim in France and Germany, and in Italy, in North Africa, Spain, That's the period of the Rishonim, runs through approximately year 1500. Over the course of the 1500s, the group that's seen as sort of the transition from Rishonim to Acharonim is the Rav Yosef Karr, the Orthodox Shulchan Aruch, and his whole coterie. And he begins in Spain, ultimately moves to Tzfat in Israel in the mid-1500s. And there's this extraordinary group of the Rav Yosef Karr, Orthodox Shulchan Aruch. The Arizal was a great Kabbalist. We'll be touching on him later on. Rav Shlomo Alkabetz is most famous to us, perhaps, as the author of L'Chadodin. A whole group of very, very creative people. Meanwhile, for Ashkenazim, the Ramaz writing his important counterpoint to the Shulchan Aruch. He lives in Krakow. I'm sure he'll be visiting. Those are going the trip. I'm sure he'll be spending some time in the Ramaz Shul in Krakow. And from the mid-1500s all the way through the mid-1600s, there is a wealth of major Jewish works being written. Many of the early commentaries on Shulchan Aruch being written there, and sort of the whole framework of Shulchan Aruch being developed over the course of that century, up until the mid-1600s. The late 1700s, fast forward a century, is a wealth of famous names in the... I mentioned before the rise of Hasidus and anti-Hasidus, the Vilna Gaon and the Baal Shem Tov, and many, many, many important works have been written late 1700s. But there's a gap. There's sort of this like awkward silence. There's a silent century from the mid-1600s to the mid-1700s. It's all quiet on the Western Front. It seems like there was a dearth of Jewish creativity. What happened? And into the middle of that quiet century, in the early 1700s, Ramchal is born. Let's try to understand what caused that step back, what caused that downgrade in Jewish creativity, what was going on. And I think it was really a 1-2 punch. The first punch lands in 1648, 1649. Chmelnytsky pogroms. Chmelnytsky comes with his hordes. Coming from the east, he's cutting across, conquering, and laying waste with a group of unusual barbarism. And they're massacring whole communities, all sorts of communities, but the Jews apparently are particular recipients of his violence. And the Chmelnytsky pogroms, 48-49, in Hebrew, Tach V'Tat, are really throw Jewish Poland into a tailspin. A tailspin from which Poland would not recover for a good century. And it's as a result that the center of gravity in terms of the Jewish Europe shifts at that point westward to Germany, with Poland in ruins. And that's why Germany becomes the center of the next cataclysm. Chmelnytsky is in the late 1640s. In the 1660s, there's a rise of the man who is probably the second most successful Jewish false messiah in history, probably second only to Jesus, and just in terms of the number of people the following that he developed, both Jewish and non-Jewish, is Shabtai Tzvi. And he's a historian, he remains an enigma in many ways. We don't know much, there's a lot of speculation about his original origins, but we do know that by the early 1660s, he's doing a brisk business, and he has a remarkable PR person in the form of Nathan of Gaza. Nathan of Gaza decided that he is Eliyahu Hanavi. He's the herald for Shabtai Tzvi's Mashiach. And they're building around, there was a strong feeling in many Christian circles that 1666 was going to be a very important messianic year. And the Jews, there are thousands, probably tens of thousands, at least, of Jews are on board. We know even from the diary of Samuel Pepys, who was in England at the time, Pepys, excuse me. He writes about these extraordinary wagers that Jews are offering, the 10-1, 20-1 odds, that the Jewish Messiah will reveal himself in Turkey in the year 1666. We have records of the real estate market collapsing in certain areas because so many were assuming that we're moving to Israel in the next couple months anyhow. And they're looking for pennies on the dollar, trying to unload their houses wherever they can, whatever they can get, and the frenzy builds. And over those years, there were so many, probably tens of thousands of Jews at least, who were really sort of building their theology and building their hopes and building their religious lives around the Shabtai Tzvi phenomenon. Things come to head in the summer of spring, summer of 1666. The Sultan takes note that season of Shabtai Tzvi. But at that point, Shabtai Tzvi is beginning to raise an army, calling himself King of the Jews. The Sultan is the title for the Emperor of the Ottoman Empire, which controlled, was centered in Turkey, controlled a wide swath. And the Sultan played hardball. He wasn't playing games. So he calls Shabtai Tzvi in for a meeting, and he offers him two choices, the turban or the sword. You can convert to Islam, or that'll be the end of your life. Shabtai Tzvi chooses the turban. And at that point, a good 98% of his followers realized that the whole thing was a farce, and he's not the real Makor. He had a couple of true believers who still felt that this was, you know, part of the process of the Hiskalis of the Rebbe, that he needs to become. They developed some sort of theory, but at that point, the vast majority of his followers realized that he was not, in fact, anything impressive. He had, over the course of his very impressive, meteoric trajectory, he had used, or abused, to be honest, many of the forms and the images of Kabbalistic thought. Mysticism had a very significant uptick over the course of the preceding century. I mentioned before the Arizal is coming on the heels of the publication of the Zohar, and Shabtai Tzvi had very deftly used Kabbalistic themes, had used mystical imagery, and all sorts of very unusual things, which until his showdown with the Sultan had bought him a very impressive following. He had these very unusually, at one point, had remarkable publicity stunts. That's what they were. He at one point announced that he was going to be getting married in a public setting, and people come, and the kal is already under the chuppah, and she's covered by a very thick veil. This is before the Baal Shem Tov, but this was a Hasidish veil, to be anachronistic. And he comes under the chuppah, and then they pull off the veil. The bride was not a human being. The bride was a Sefer Torah. He was marrying, quote-unquote, Sefer Torah. A brilliant PR stunt. Horrific abuse of real Jewish thinking, and specifically horrific abuse of Jewish mysticism. I mentioned before that after the 1640s, when Tath B'Tath, the first terrible punch that landed on 17th century Jewry, it really laid waste to Poland. The center of gravity had moved to Germany. And Germany was, in certain ways, was particularly hurt by the aftermath of Shabtai Tzvi. And they became very allergic as a result because of the abuse of Kabbalah. Germany became very allergic to Kabbalah in general. So much so, I don't know how many of you have ever davened at a German shul, Breuer's in Washington Heights or anywhere else? Anyone with a German background? Okay. So okay, Breuer's, there you go. Good Washington Heights. So you go there, and if they have their own nusach and their own tunes, and they have a choir, it's very picturesque, it's very beautiful. You come on a laning day, some mentioned before, only coming to Musaf on Shabbos. So if you come early for Musaf, you get to the Kriyas HaTorah, there's a paragraph that is missing from the Seder. They do not say Brich Shemei when they take out the Sefer Torah. Since the mid-1600s, Brich Shemei happens to be a passage from the Zohar, and the German Jewish community developed such a to Kabbalah, having seen how it was abused, that to this day they became they're very very as you said Kabbalah averse. And over the course of the late 1600s, there are some copycats, Jacob Frank, a couple of other false messiahs. No one quite has the run the Shabtai Tzvi does, but things are going from bad to worse, and it's into the. And that, I believe, is why you have this whole, as mentioned before, this quiet century. From the mid-1600s, mid-1700s, where there isn't really Jewish creativity in quite the way there was before or after. And it's in the smack in the middle of this quiet century that Moshe Chaim Luzzatto was born in Padua, a sleepy town in Italy. Not far, the big city in the area is Venice. And he is apparently a very brilliant young man. One need not to be successful at Torah learning. One need not be brilliant to be successful in most fields. Often hard work is far more important than brilliance. Happens to be, he was an unusually brilliant prodigy. And one of the things that's interesting about Padua is one of the things that distinguishes the otherwise sleepy town at the time, sleepy town of Padua, the University of Padua in the early 1700s was the only university in Europe which admitted Jews to its medical school. And what's the significance of that? I have a number of mothers in the room. Any mother wants to say my son, any Jewish mother wants to say my son the doctor, in the early 1700s, he's headed to Padua. So the otherwise sleepy town of Padua has this unusual concentration of young Jewish brain power. Any future Jewish doctor is there. As a matter of fact, we'll get back to this fellow in just a moment. There's a fellow by the name of Yechezkel Gordon, later in life Dr. Yechezkel Gordon, who hailed from Vilna, Lithuania, traveled 1,500 miles from Vilna to Padua to study medicine. He ultimately returns back to the Lithuanian community. And later in life, in the late 1700s, he's actually the one who introduces the Vilna Gaon to works of his Rebbe, the Ramchal. Because Ramchal soon outgrows his tutors. There has been a yeshiva in Padua, but his Rebbe, Yerushalayim Bassan, if you care to follow along in the timeline, Rabbi Yerushalayim Bassan leaves for Reggio when Ramchal is only 15 years old. And so he's searching around for a group with whom to learn and discovers that the med students at Padua have their own chabura, they have their own Beis HaMedrash, and they learn. And, you know, everyone's on their own schedule, different fellows are taking different courses, and they're coming and going over the course of the day. And he joins their group. He's a couple years younger than them. He joins their group, and they soon realize that they have in him not only a peer, but a leader. And they realize that he's many steps ahead of them in learning. And he's studying with them for a couple of years. And we actually have, it's a thin volume published, Takanos Beis HaMedrash, are the guidelines for this Beis HaMedrash. It was a very special place. These are people who are very young, idealistic, brilliant, and driven people. They're people who are making time for the Torah Mada 300 years ago. And these are Jews who are making time for Torah and medicine, and very, very spiritual group. Very idealistic group. And they have a series of guidelines for how their base measure is meant to be handled. They have rules for chit-chat also. A remarkable thing. They tell you that you can only chat in the base medrash as opposed to learning. You follow three conditions. Number one, it can't be during the official learning times. You know, during off hours, you can chat if you want. But number two, not up at the front, not at the Rebbe's desk. Ramchal's desk is sacred. And number three, you want to chit-chat quietly, it's fine. But the way it's written there is you cannot raise your voice in the base medrash except with pilpul ha-gemara, except in the back and forth of arguing one's chavrusa over Gemara, which is important because it also tells us there was Gemara learned there. You see, when you look at the way they describe their base medrash, it seems like it was more Zohar. One would get the impression it was more Zohar than anything else. As a matter of fact, one of the unusual customs they had, I don't know if Dafyomi is a thing in Scarsdale or not. Okay, you're familiar with the concept, right? So you start every day, you learn a page, the next day you learn the next page, up to, you know, you pick up where you left off the day before. They had a very unique system for learning Zohar. They wanted their base medrash to be involved as a group, and there was a lot of sense of, a very strong sense of collaboration, that as a group we should be learning from dawn till dusk, from Vasik and Shachris until Min Chamar. Now everyone's going to class, everyone's on a different schedule, so they had shifts. But the way it worked is there was one table that had a big copy of the Zohar, and one set of chavrusas is studying, and then when their shift is over, they're going line by line by line, when their shift is over, the next group comes in, sits down, and picks up from where they're up to. And so as a group, and there's a lot in their writing about pooling their resources and pooling their impact, both intellectually and spiritually, to see themselves not just as acting for ourselves, but acting for the group, and they, over time, you see their thinking maturing to where we're doing it for the Jewish people. And there's one more, so there was a lot of Zohar going on, but there was also clearly a lot of Gemara going on, so there's this healthy mix. And then one more rule I need to share with you, and that really also opens the door to the controversy that lurks. That was one of the more unusual rules in this work, Takanos Beis HaMedrash, is that there's this line there that during off hours, any member of the Beis Medrash can ask for privacy. Any member of the Beis Medrash with all privacy could say, I need the Beis Medrash to myself. I'll ask you all to please leave. I need some privacy. What's that all about? So there was a fair amount of mysticism, and there was presumably a fair amount of meditation. And maybe you were in the zone, you needed some quiet yourself. But I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, Yechezkel Gordon, a Lithuanian medical student, who later returned to be a Jewish doctor in Vilna. And he was particularly taken with his young Rebbe, the Ramchal, and he was very curious. Well, so there always has to be that guy, right? Although if it isn't that guy, then the story doesn't get told. He was that guy who was really curious, what's his Rebbe up to? Well, what does Ramchal do when he has his private time of his marriage? So apparently he sneaks in, and it comes to the conclusion, correctly or otherwise, that Ramchal is studying in private with Eliyahu HaNavi. Okay. Yechezkel Gordon sort of sits on this fascinating information for a couple of months. Within 6 months, he can't keep it inside. He's written a letter to the Jewish establishment of Germany, telling them about his Rav the Ramchal, how wonderful their Chabur is, and how remarkable, what a remarkable figure they're led by. Ramchal is a Talmudist, and he's a Kabbalist, and he even speaks with Eliyahu HaNavi. Now, historians are not sure to this day what Yechezkel Gordon's motivation was. Some think that it was a fundraising letter. Some think that it's an old issue. And some think he was just so proud. He wanted everyone else to be as proud of Ramchal as he was. Whatever his motivation was, it backfired horrific. And we, with the contest, we appreciate that they read this letter. They hear about this young, single, clean-shaven fellow who's teaching, studying Kabbalah with a bunch of medical students and claims to be speaking with Eliyahu HaNavi. They said, we have the next shot that's in our hands. This guy is trouble. And instead of investigating, they do a little bit of investigating, but the die is cast almost from the outset. And they send a series of pretty vigorous letters to Venice, which, as I mentioned before, is the big city. Padua is sort of in the orbit of Venice. And they send the German rabbis send letters to the Venice establishment. You better, this fellow is trouble, you better root him out. And if you're following along in the timeline, you see that's when he's around 22. His activities become publicized, and as you see, within a year, he's shut down. Within a year, the pressure is very intense. They reach out to his Rebbe from his earlier days. Venice establishment reaches out to Rabbi Yishaya Basan, and he tries to mediate. Doesn't go anywhere. We have a lot of correspondence. This volume is one of several volumes that's been published. This close to 200 letters every which way. Letters from Germany to Venice, and then from Venice to Padua, and Yishaya Basan in conversation with the establishment in Venice, Yishaya Basan in conversation with his student, Moshe Chaim Litzato. At one point he says to him, it would probably be a good idea to get married anyways, and I think this might also be a good strategic move. It doesn't help. He apparently marries happily, but with great personal happiness, but nothing that he can do can hold off the tsunami of pressure. It gets so bad that he tells his group of medical students, you're better off without me. We have very touching letters back and forth between them.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
What exactly was he doing he wasn't practicing Shabtai Tzviism. Well, so what did they point at that he was doing that they opposed?
Right. So
commiserating with Eliyahu HaNavi.
Well, even 300 years later, the German community is still so allergic or averse to Kabbalah that they won't even recite a passage of the Zohar. So at that point, it was very raw, and it was not an unreasonable concern. The whole picture, especially since in the Torah of the Arizal, who was a very significant Kabbalist in the 1500s, as having a beard was seen as a very central grooming for any aspiring Kabbalist. But this whole business of here, this young, clean-shaven fellow, the whole picture didn't fit. It didn't sound authentic. It sounded like he was authentic. We know from looking at the literature that he produced. But to sort of looking from the outside, they made a quick snap judgment, and on paper it sounded like trouble. And they're really worried that he's starting a movement. And he's going to start a movement, and he's going to sort of build a cult around himself, a cult of personality, and he's going to ultimately proclaim himself as some sort of Messiah, and we're going to, it's going to happen all over again. I should mention, over this period, he's studying with this group, and he's supporting him, so he worked for a number of years as an optician, and he was also a very prolific, not only a prolific writer, but not just a writer of the Torah. His first published work actually is as a 17-year-old. Nowadays, publishing is much more common than it was in the 1700s. So he published his first work as a 17-year-old. It was a secular work. Lashon Limudim was a book in Hebrew about good writing and good rhetoric. Over the course of most of his playwriting work and poetry was produced during his younger Italian years. We have a slew of poems that he wrote. Like Yehuda Halevi, most have very overt religious themes, and some do not. He actually gave as a present to one of his students upon his graduation present, when his fellow graduated medical school, he gave him a poem, a personalized poem as a souvenir. He wrote several plays during that era also. I'm not an expert, maybe Mrs. Levin can help us out here. I'm not an expert on early 18th century playwriting, but apparently he was attuned to contemporary style. We know of two major plays that he wrote. One is about the story of Shimshon, the story of Samson, dramatized. And the other is La'isharim Tehila. It's a morality play. That's a more of a medieval style, where it's a romance. There's a boy named Yashar and a girl named Tehila, and the relationship develops, they're supposed to marry, and then this dastardly fellow comes along and walks off with Tehila, and then the whole drama ensues, and it's a morality play in the sense that, like many of the medieval morality plays, the characters have, rather than having human names, their names are names of character traits. So Yashar is the young man, is the white hat, so to speak. Yashar is a fellow who's honest. The young woman is Tehila. And the play can be read in several levels. It can be read as a romance. It can be read as a work of Musar, about the interaction of different good and bad mitos within the personality of human being. And apparently, it could be read on a Kabbalistic level as well. So his time in Padua is incredibly productive. But it comes to an end in his early 20s. And the pressure builds to the extent that he tells his group, "You're better off without me. You're better off without me." They protest, but he insists, "You'll better off without me. But at this point, I'm just an albatross around your neck. I'm just a liability." And he leaves. He leaves Italy entirely. He decides to strike out for Holland. He heads to the Netherlands, to Amsterdam. There's a Sephardic community there. Netherlands even then had a reputation for being far more tolerant. And he figures that he'll go to Amsterdam and he'll have a more peaceful existence to be able to teach and write unobstructed. The problem is that this is almost three centuries ago, before modern transportation. He leaves Italy in the fall. The snows stop him midway. So he doesn't make it to Amsterdam until the spring. He ends up wintering. The halfway point, if you imagine the map of Europe, he's starting out in the boots of Italy, he's headed up to the northwest corner up there in the Netherlands. He ends up spending the winter in Germany, ironically, actually in Frankfurt. He spends the winter in Frankfurt, irony of ironies, and it's a very mixed bag that winter. Because on the one hand, he has a chance to commiserate with another great Torah scholar who had also been falsely accused of being a Sabbatean, Jonathan Eibeschitz, had his own controversy with Yaakov Emdin, who accused him of a Sabbatinism. Yosef Eibeschitz was at that point many decades older than Ramchal. One imagines that we know that they met. One imagines there must have been a certain degree of comfort for Ramchal to be able to commiserate with someone else who had gone through similar experiences. But it was very much a mixed bag that winter. He probably had some comfort in his conversations with Yosef Eibeschitz, but many of the people who had led the charge against him now had him at close quarters until the snows melted. And we know that he had left Italy with a crate, probably packed everything in a series of crates. There was one whole crate just of manuscripts. Probably historians estimate probably 100 to 150 books and manuscripts that had not yet been published, only copies of those books in this crate. He doesn't leave Germany with that crate. The crate is confiscated, it's buried in a swamp somewhere outside of Frankfurt, and there lies decomposing to this day. And the conversations are also not pleasant. And we have letters that Ramchal is writing to his Rebbe during and after his time in Germany, where he says he was maltreated, not physically maltreated, but he was pushed around and he was manipulated, and he said it was terrible. But he says, but I'm going to keep, they imposed more, they had already made him promise, while he was still in Italy, that he would limit his activities, and they imposed an additional oath on him in Germany. He says it was absolutely unethical the way I was treated, it was terrible, but I'm an honest person, and even though I was mistreated, I'm going to keep my end of the deal. Yes, yeah, family goes in. Yes, absolutely. Family goes in. He had, I believe, two children. I think they travel. There are more travels to come. I think they travel, as far as I know, they travel as a family all the way through. One imagines he must have been very relieved when the snow started melting. And he gets out of, he skedaddles out of Germany, and he heads to Amsterdam, and the Amsterdam community is thrilled that they were chosen to be the, you think about all the cities are jockeying for Amazon to, to land, build your HQ2 here. So the Jewish community in Amsterdam they were thrilled. They were honored, they were thrilled. They get advance notice that he's coming, there's this incredible reception, a kabbal is upon him, and he arrives, and it's wonderful, and then the keynote speaker, they put the Ramchal to speak, and they're expecting that the sparks will fly in the Sephardic community. They revered Kabbalah. And they're expecting the sparks will fly and we'll be hearing about angels and this and that. Ramchal gets up to speak and he speaks very well. Nothing mystical. They're wondering what's going on. They figure, he came off of a long trip. It's been a long couple of months and a long couple of years. So they figure we'll give him a couple of weeks to relax and to rest up. And then they can have another major public event. He's again the keynote speaker. And once again, he gives a beautiful shiur. But the mystical sparks are absent. And now they're really wondering, where did it go? They do a little bit of digging, and they discover that, as Ramchal had written to his Rebbe, he's keeping his end of the deal. He had promised when he left, before he left Germany, he had been forced to give his word that he would no longer teach Kabbalah, no longer share any mystical teachings, neither verbally nor in writing. So he says he plans to keep his end of the deal. And he writes to his Rebbe, I'm not going to give it up in terms of my own personal study, but I'm no longer going to be teaching, I'm no longer going to be sharing it. And that's why there's a detail that seems like the sort of, I don't know what sort of memories people around the table have about high school history. But sometimes people might have these... some people might have had experience led them to believe that history is boring because of all names, dates, and places. So the following fact sounds like sort of the apex of that. The year and location of first publication of a book. What could be more boring than that? Until you put things in context. Names, dates, and places are fascinating when you see history as a study of themes. You see history as a study of the forces and the development of... different unfolding phenomena. Mesillas Yesharim, Ramchal's most famous work by far, I mentioned before, widely 150 printings over the last less than three centuries, studied so broadly, Hasidim, Mesnagdim, Mordechai Kaplan, any which way you turn. And it's his classic work of Jewish ethics, of Jewish self-improvement, The Path of the Just. It's published for the first time in Amsterdam, I believe in the year 1740. Without this context, that sounds like a useless bit of information. With this context, it means worlds. It's the first major work Ramchal publishes after arriving in Amsterdam. It's the first major work Ramchal publishes, in other words, after having accepted that he's no longer going to be teaching the depth, much of the depth he has to offer. The halachic depth, yes. The philosophical depth, yes. The literary depth, yes, but the Kabbalistic depth is being shelved. Or is it? He's a man with extraordinary, such a multidimensional thinker, such a profound person. You open up Ramchal, the language is very, you open up Mesilas Yesharim, excuse me, the language is incredibly simple. The language is very plain, very straightforward. But the ideas are profound. And appreciation of the man behind the book and the point in his life that he was at when he wrote it gives you the impression that it certainly is what it purports to be. It's a work about Jewish self-improvement, Jewish ethics. An encyclopedic reorganization, almost in my Maimonidean style, of all of the bits and pieces on this topic strewn throughout Talmud and Medrash, organized into a very succinct logical flow. That's what it purports to be. One aspect of the historical perspective is, you know, you can hear echoes when you hear about him describing different profiles of people and how different people handle situations well or poorly. You definitely hear echoes of people he had encountered in his life, and people who had handled themselves with dignity and with elegance, and people who had not. And then also, one notices that there are 26 chapters of Mesilas Yesharim, which any aspiring Kabbalist will know immediately as the gematria of the Hashem's name, Yud Hei Vav Hei, and you notice right away that there's something afoot. And that's probably part of the significance. In the opening paragraph of Mesilas Yesharim, the opening paragraph of the introduction, he writes, you know, it's the last thing you expect to hear if someone's trying to sell their book. He says, I have to tell you. You can read my books, like one of these How to Use This Book paragraphs. He says, I have to warn you in advance. You'll read my book. He says, it's almost like before and after. He says, if you examine your mind, examine your brain after having read my book, there won't be that many new ideas that weren't there before. I don't have so much to say. I don't have so many new ideas to say. He says, you won't really gain that much from reading it once. He says, if you really read it again and again and again, and you review it, then you really plug into what I'm teaching. And he writes there, and it's definitely a profound insight about the human condition. He says, it's the things that we know most that tend to be the most important, and that we tend to forget most quickly. I'm not here to tell you the things you don't know. Much of what I have to tell you, you know. But the things we know that we tend to ignore. And by reading my book repeatedly, those ideas that we ought to be living our lives, the way we ought to be handling other people, the way we ought to be handling our own frustrations, our own goals, and managing our lives, the things we know we ought to be doing, you'll read my book several times, and then it'll be not just here, but here. It won't just be what I know, but it'll be how I live. That's certainly true. It's also true that Ramchal definitely been very humble, and he has plenty of fascinating ideas over the course of the work. And he probably also means that there are multiple layers of depth to his work that, with repeated reading over the course of years, with added insight, with added study, with added profundity, and with added life experience, the same ideas take on different perspectives. What I want to do right now, I want to wrap up with the next Rabbi Klinger suggests we wrap up at 10-2, and then turn to questions. So I want to turn the page for the next 5 minutes. I want to wrap up with actually, now that we've met the man, let's have a lick of the work. We need to get a little bit of the flavor. You remember how we opened? What are your associations with the Musar Sefer? Right. The dusty old book and the old man with the long white beard, very otherworldly. Now we've met a man who was in the best sense of the world, very this worldly and otherworldly. And a man who was incredibly cosmopolitan and incredibly spiritual. You know, when I think about it, with the paradigm of Torah Mada, think about a man who is comfortable with the full swath of Talmudic writing, a man who is an expert Kabbalist, a man who learned B'charuz Eliyahu HaNavi, and a man who is a playwright and a poet and an optician, that's you know, certainly an admirable, a Renaissance man in the best sense of the term. So let's take a look at just a taste of the introduction in the first chapter. mentioned before that the opening paragraph of introduction, you tell how to use this book, right? You're going to need to read this several times before it really begins to sink in. What's the opening paragraph? The balance of his introduction is really devoted to a single thesis. And that is that this book matters. In other words, that the study of being a good Jew, of how to worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and how to develop myself as a person, that those are intellectually rigorous disciplines. And he develops, he points out that so many assume that whether I'm interested in Torah or Mada, if I'm a bright, curious, intellectually driven person, I'm not going to waste my time on self-improvement and Musar. That's, you know, his choice words there. He says too many intelligent people think that those fields are not for them. And the truth is, if capable people don't study them, so then their riches lie untouched. But he argues that the central thesis of introduction, that in fact the study of self-improvement and of worshiping HaKadosh Baruch Hu is actually a very demanding intellectual discipline. At the end of the introduction, having made that point, he says, well, if indeed we can take this seriously, we can do this in a rigorous fashion, the first thing we need to do is define our terms. We need to define the scope of the discipline. What is exactly that we're studying? What do you mean to worship God? Well, sort of take that for granted, but what is it? That's a logical place to start. As you see here, this is quote number one. He writes that a person who thinks, Misha Yisbonein, a person who stops to think, a contemplative person who isn't just sort of coasting through life, will recognize that to be deeply religious, to be authentically religiously ambitious, that's what the term chasidus means, religious ambition, it doesn't depend, it doesn't depend on the sort of the silly things like the rolling in snow and the endless fasting and so on and so forth, self-abnegation. It doesn't mean what people think superficially might think it means. Rather, it's something deep and beautiful and real and true. Shleimus amiti v'chachma rabba. I say, so where are we going to look? The best primary source for a question of what does God want of us is the Chumash. As a matter of fact, it's one of the only direct questions posed in all of Chumash outside of narrative. You know, of the course of Chumash, in narrative sections, you'll have conversation between people. But in the non-narrative sections of Chumash, this might be, if not the only, one of the only direct questions in all of Chumash. V'ata Yisrael, now Jews, what does God ask of you? There it is. Presented, asked directly. Ramchal points out that if you read the ensuing psukim, Moshe Rabbeinu enumerates five aspects. To fear Hashem, Yiras Hashem, to walk in his ways, to love him, to worship him wholeheartedly, and to keep the mitzvahs. Ramchal has a lot to say, and we have little time. I hope this will, but let's talk about this at least for another minute or two, and I hope this will whet your appetite to pull the dusty Mesillas Yesharim off the shelf and have to take a fresh look, reintroduce ourselves to that book, introduce or reintroduce ourselves to that book. He asks a couple of simple questions, or implies a couple of simple questions. One of them is, what does it mean to fear God, to love God? Does God want us to be theophobic? Are we bad Jews because we're not shivering? We're not scared? Ought we to be walking around scared of God? Here's the item number one, to fear God. What does it mean? See, he offers a more sophisticated understanding that it's not about, and time doesn't allow us to develop this length, that it would be a mistranslation to talk about fear. It would be a far better translation to talk about awareness or consciousness, to be God conscious, to be God aware. that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the reality, the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not just something that if you ask me, yes, I subscribe to, sort of cerebrally, but something that I feel. Right? We all know that we act differently around different people. Even if we're not embarrassed at what we're saying or doing, we naturally, well, even psychologists have noted that there are any well-adapted person has different discourse distances. We naturally stand at different distances to people depending on what our relationship is like. Right? And we do it intuitively. We naturally we are aware of the presence of others. To be aware of the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in an intuitive way, that's not an easy thing. But these are sort of the five, these, none of these five things are things that are going to happen right away. But these are sort of the five long-term goals, the five long-term targets that that a serious Jew would aim for. He also notes, he has a plain to say, what does it mean to love God? Time doesn't allow us to get into that at all. Maybe some other time. But I'll leave you with the one final observation. We'll turn then open the floor to more questions. He points out that it's something a little strange about this list. Right? To fear God, to love God, to walk in his ways, whatever that means. Ram Chaz what to say about that also. It doesn't mean that he, you know, the hutch versus the spring, but whoa, to walk in his ways, to worship, it sounds all internal. Some of these are mitzvahs, though. The last item is to keep all the mitzvahs. Ram Chaz says, 1 second. Well, keep all the mitzvahs. Yeah, if you ask me what are my favorite desserts, so I said, I really like banana split flavored ice cream. I really like Belgian chocolate ice cream. I really like pistachio ice cream. And I really like ice cream. Something off there. Right? I gave specifics, and then I give you another item on the list, sort of the general set. Isn't that what happened here? Fearing God is one of the 613 mitzvahs. Loving God is one of the 613 mitzvahs. And then you say, and to keep all the mitzvahs. You just say to keep all the mitzvahs and leave out the rest of the specifics. Ramchal points out in a manuscript version of Maseilas Yesharim that the impression you get is that item number 5, to keep the mitzvahs, that means the external, behavioral mitzvahs. The mitzvahs of the hands and feet and the mouth. The external, the behavioral obligations of a Jew. What the classic Jewish writers refer to as the chovas ha'ivar. The obligations of the limbs. How a Jew ought to behave. The first four items aren't a part of that. The first four items are chovas halavavos. Those are about the inner landscape of the Jew. How a Jew aspires to think, to feel, to cogitate. And what's fascinating is that the way Moshe Rabbeinu organizes his presentation, 80% of this critical list is internal, which drives home the entire point of Ramchal's work, Maseilas Yesharim, and in many ways his life's work as a whole. That while behaviors are critical, but behaviors divorced from the inner life of a Jew is like a body without soul. And the penimius of a Jew, what's going on within, is very much a part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's normative expectations, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's dreams for how we can be and how we can develop. And that in many ways sets off the life of the Ramchal. I would love to take questions. I want to, before I take questions, to circle around again to thank the rabbinic leadership, Rabbi Klinger and Morgenstern, and to thank Mrs. Levitt for spurring this idea. The floor is open. Yeah.
So yes. I'm wondering how this, I don't know if it's Pakuda, right?
Right.
When he lived, and just a brief contrast between the two.
Sure, I'm glad you asked. Rabbi Bachi and Pakuda lived a little more than 1,000 years ago. So obviously well before Ramchal. Sort of ended, I guess you could say, end of the period of going to the beginning of the Rishonim. And he wrote a work entitled Chovas HaLevavos. As a matter of fact, in the introduction, Chovas HaLevavos again is the duties of the heart. In other words, the inner landscape of the Jew, the inner obligations of a Jew. And he writes as a very fascinating introduction. He says he surveys all of Torah literature that exists at the time, all of post-Talmudic Torah literature, the last 500 years. And he says, we have this genre, that genre, this or that. He says, no one's writing. Yeah, people are writing on Tanakh, people are writing on Gemara and a Halacha, but all the halachic works are focused on the Chovas HaEvar, on the behavioral expectations. There's no one's writing about the inner life of the Jews. He's very dramatic. He said, well, maybe God doesn't care what's going on inside of us. And that was the canard about Judaism, that religion of deed but not creed. It just all that matters is what we do. It doesn't matter how we think, how we feel, and so forth. But he demonstrates extensively, he says, that's a straw man. He says, it's obviously false, and let me show you. And he says, I don't know why no one's written about it, but and I don't feel worthy, but no one else has done it, so I'm going to jump in. And he writes a masterpiece on what he sees as the 10 major aspects of the inner life of the Jew. Ramchal was definitely familiar with Chovas HaLevavos, for sure. Ramchal generally does not quote by name any post-Talmudic works. He'll quote Gemara, he'll quote Medrash, and he'll quote ideas, but will rarely reference, in a very Maimonidean style. He was Maimonidean in many ways, in form and content. He, and like Maimonides, it was incredibly accepted within generations after his passing, but during his life was subject to Maimonides' works were burned, and Ramchal's works were buried in a swamp. I'm not sure how they stack up. But the similarities are striking, both negatively and positively. Yeah, please.
Do we still have his secular works, his poetry?
We have there are collections of. I imagine some of it was destroyed. But we have a lot of it. We have a lot of it still extant. If you're interested, I could try to find some links and send them to you.
I wanted to ask you a question, but before I do, I was going to make a suggestion. I'll submit to you that the fifth element on this list, to keep the mitzvah, I could construe as meaning, in order to do the first four, to ensure that you accomplish the first four, the mechanism for doing it is to keep the mitzvah.
Oh. And that's probably how it strikes me. I like that very much. In matter of fact, Ramchal is one of the most famous passages in Mesilas Yesharim, that at the end of the seventh chapter, talks about the interplay between inside and outside. And he says, you know, he talks about different stages in personal growth. So one of the early ones is developing enthusiasm. And not just doing what you have to, because you have to do it, but if you recognize the value of something, you're going to do it with energy, with excitement, with enthusiasm. And he says that Mesilas Yesharim is a very practical work. It's a how-to book. It's not meant to be, it's applied philosophy. It's not abstract philosophy. So he says these are good intentions, very nice words, but let's say I'm just not feeling it. So he says, if you're not feeling it, do it. Not as a faker, but if I wish I felt that way within and I don't yet feel that way, so act the way someone who felt that would act. I don't feel enthusiastic. I'm not driven to run to shul, to run to do a chesed, to run to hospital, to see someone. I'll do what I have to do because I have to do it, but I'm not running. He said, if you don't feel like running, don't worry. Just run anyhow. And if you get into the habit of running in time, and again, running both literally and figuratively, the drive within will come. And he writes there about how, you know, ideally, what's going on within will express itself in behavior. But we can't directly wrap our hands around what's going on within, but I can more, it's hard to control our own behaviors also, but I have more control over behavior than over feeling and thought. He said that there's this very positive or powerful cycle that I can harness productively. I can harness it productively. I can act a certain way that will generate that, and that cycle, the flywheel, will take off. You're absolutely right.
Would you say that Mesilas Yesharim was inspired to write it as a reaction to how he was treated in Germany?
Could be.
And the follow-up was, he wrote Derech Hashem, right?
Right.
Where does that fit into the historical context?
That's a good question. I don't remember.
Did it come before or after Mesilas Yesharim?
I would suspect that it comes before. I don't remember for sure, though. I have to check it out.
But it seems like, for the way you presented it and the timeline, that it was a reaction to...
No, the Derech Hashem thing is written earlier. The Derech Hashem is about God. The Mesilas Yesharim is about human beings.
Yeah, and that would be a reaction.
It may well have been, at least in part. He discovered that there was a need for self-improvement tools.
Wasn't he in the diamond business in addition to optics?
There is
a connection.
Yes.
Between diamond wheel.
Yes,
and
maybe. Got to find out, yeah.
I missed what... What do the foolish, pious people think?
Oh, so you're right to notice that. I'm glad you picked up on that. That's sort of, this is where we're jumping into the middle. So he had been describing the preceding paragraphs. Lots of people, he says, because Avos Hashem is often studied in a very non-rigorous way, so people have all these ideas, and, you know, to be very religious is to cut yourself off from the world. And the more, the way the Rambam writes several centuries before him, right. Rabbi writes that we Jews proudly reject the notion that's common in many other theologies, that the most religious person is he or she who is most cut off from this world. And the most religious person in many of the theologies is the monk who's is totally a hermit, is totally cut off from the world, and any worldly engagement is a concession. The Rambam writes in the third chapter of Deos that that's absurd, it's not a Jewish concept. And that's what he's writing here. So a lot of people think he had written the previous paragraphs. So a lot of people think that, oh, you know, I'll roll in the snow, that was a medieval thing, and I'll fast, and I'll sort of, there's a lot of self-abnegation, it'll make me feel very religious. He says, yeah, but feeling very religious is not where it's at. But let's actually work on this. These are deep questions, let's work them through. And we'll discover it's actually something deep and meaningful and beautiful.